Hi, and welcome to the Applied Medication Safety Podcast. This episode is a great follow-up to the ones that we just had, where we had talked with an ED physician, an ED specialist, about some of the concerns regarding anticoagulation. So this week, we have a primary care physician, the person who's on the receiving end of so many of these patients that are coming through the ED, the one who is managing these patients and caring for them on the long term. And let's see how their concerns differ from those of the acute care. So I'm really happy in this season two, we're talking about the safety of anticoagulants, to have this primary care physician speak to us. So let's take a listen. Well, welcome to the Applied Medication Safety Podcast. We have a focus on anticoagulants, and I am so happy that you're here as a primary care physician. And I, without going into anything further, perhaps you'd like to explain to our audience a little bit more about the kinds of patients you see, the kind of work that you do, and then get into it.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. And I'm primary care for nearly 20 years, so we do see a wide range of patients, from acute issues, patients with acute thrombosis or blood clots, pulmonary embolisms, but the large, vast majority of patients who are treated with anticoagulants, I would say, in our clinics are people that we're treating to prevent stroke because they have arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation. This is generally what we're managing.
Very well. And you're seeing patients then who are coming out of the acute care side of things and have perhaps a different appreciation for some of the risks and benefits associated with those direct oral anticoagulants, as well as some of the traditional methods such as warfarin. So maybe you can comment, I guess, first on how you decide what's the most appropriate patient to match to that therapy, and what kinds of risks you're thinking of, like what makes a person appropriate for a DOAC versus warfarin, and then we'll talk about some of the other therapy pieces.
Yeah, those are great questions, and it's a good segue, because my perspective is definitely different than the acute care, and then there's that transition from the acute care. It's very easy to give a person a prescription for a direct oral anticoagulant, just a prescription for a pill to take without much education in the inpatient setting, and then send them out to their primary care doctor without much discussion about what fits that patient best. And what I'm thinking about is longitudinal care, taking care of a patient over the spectrum of their life. So if this is a person who's going to be on indefinite anticoagulation, we have to think about what is best for them. And that may depend on the patient's age or the patient's income. It may depend on their home life and how much help they have at home, how their transportation. So when we're talking about the difference between warfarin or vitamin K dependent agent versus the direct oral anticoagulants, that's a big difference. And the majority of my patients, or at least more than half of my patients, are Medicare patients. So cost comes into the discussion when I'm talking to patients. And if we're thinking about an acute, maybe 3 to 6 months of taking a medication versus lifelong. So that's part of the discussion with the patient. And then their ability to get to a clinic or get to a lab to have their blood checked. If they're on warfarin, then they need to have their INR monitored. If they're able to adhere to diet and medication restrictions, questions of drug interactions with warfarin versus the direct oral anticoagulants. So those are part of the discussion that I have to have with the patients up front. I will tell you that the uptake, when you ask a patient and you kind of compare these, if this is someone who's going to be on a medication indefinitely and you give them the initial option of come in at least initially very frequently and maybe once a month to have your blood checked for your INR versus you don't have to come in at all. That sounds really great to a patient initially. And then you have to start drilling down into the cost considerations and what is their coverage with their prescription plan.
So you mentioned coming in once a week for the warfarin monitoring, and certainly that there's that INR. What kind of value do you find in the home test kits or the capacity of patients to be able to do home monitoring with less frequent visits to the office?
There's certainly value there. And I have, it's really a very small fraction of patients that do that. They have to have a certain level of healthcare literacy and understanding. And it has to be someone who we know is going to be actually consistent with it and vigilant in obtaining the INR and reporting to the office. And it's so that we know that they're monitored. It takes the right patient to do that. That's not going to be everyone. And it certainly would not be, some patients have a hard time just checking their blood sugar, you know, and they have diabetes, and we really need them to monitor that on a daily basis. And so some people just have a fear of doing that type of thing at home on their own. Or, you know, that's a barrier for patients. So I don't see that quite as much.
Okay. So a small fraction of patients have capacity for home monitoring. There's a perhaps larger subsection that will come in for weekly monitoring. And do you feel like that's being driven by drug price more than anything else? Because it would seem convenience-wise, having to come in once a month is, you know, sign me up for that, but at what cost? And so how does the cost factors of these agents play into this decision-making that you've seen for your patients?
That is the major consideration for most of the patients, is the cost. And we talked about transitioning from the acute setting to the outpatient setting. You know, you may be able in the ED to get 30 days initial prescription for free, or when you're discharged from the hospital and they come to see me for their hospital follow-up visit. And that's when they get that sticker shock, because then they realize, oh, my next prescription will cost X, or it's not covered. Maybe my patient's on Medicare Part D and they don't have coverage for that drug, or it might cost them $500 to $600 for a month of that medication. So when we have a discussion up front and I say, I'm not sure how much this will cost you, we can investigate that. But these medications are going to have a significant cost associated with them versus warfarin.
How often do you find a situation where they maybe started on one that was perhaps given to them for free, but that actually isn't a preferred agent for their insurance and need to transition to another agent? And what kind of reaction do you get from patients? Are they very much of the mindset of, well, this is working, I don't want to change what's working, versus this is horribly expensive, and if the other is going to be comparable, then by all means change? Is it kind of a split 50-50, or is it an easy transition, or is it kind of difficult, do you think?
I would say it's highly variable. I've had patients that say, you know, it's just easy for me. I haven't had any complications. I haven't any problems. I'll pay for it. That's not the typical patient. The other alternative, yes, there are patients that say, well, I'll take whatever's covered because I recognize the cost. It can be a definite burden, and obviously it plays into people's decisions. And it's unfortunate that in medicine, people have to make decisions based on the price tag of their drug, not the most effective or beneficial medication. But we have had people that transition. And then even patients who maybe their pharmacy manager or the prescription plan changes, and they've been on one drug, but it's no longer preferred and the cost goes up. And we have had discussions of patients going to warfarin from a direct oral anticoagulant because of the cost, or their life changes, their financial situation changes.
Now, with the warfarin, to kind of start to segue into some of the safety concerns, warfarin has been a mainstay of anticoagulant therapy for literally decades. We have a test that identifies the level, the therapeutic window that we want to reach. It's been well established what targets are most beneficial for patients. And there's a known reversal agent, vitamin K, that is, even if you can't get it in pill form, there's a variety of foods with nutritional value with vitamin K that can be used to mitigate excess anticoagulation. So when it comes to the DOACs and the concern for safety, of course, too much leads to the risk of bleeding, too little leads to the risk of clots or thrombosis, and typically that risk of thrombosis is most closely associated with non-adherence. People forget to take their pet medications they can't afford. They try to be parsimonious and stretch them out, take a half a tablet to do cost savings. So as the clinician, what are you really most concerned about with your patient population?
So all good points. I'm most concerned really about, because again, I'm more often treating patients to prevent stroke. So I'm more concerned about stroke risk and non-adherence or incorrect utilization of the drug. So they may be, I had a patient just last week who told me she's taking her apixaban every other day because of the cost. And no, you absolutely can't do that. And these are stories that I get, you know, very frequently, or patients who just stopped and didn't tell anybody that they stopped the medication. So I'm actually more concerned about that. I've actually even seen a patient who had a stroke while taking rivaroxaban or Xarelto, not taking it correctly, not taking it with food. And, you know, you might scratch your head. So the education on starting these drugs, whether they're started inpatient or outpatient, I think is critical. How they're dosed, how they're used, and the importance of taking it, or even communicating if you're having struggles with getting the medication so we can correctly anticoagulate you. But the risk of stroke to me is a much greater risk. And that bears out in studies that look at the stroke versus bleeding risk for patients on the direct oral anticoagulants. That's much more of a concern for me than the bleeding risk if someone is on the medication and taking it appropriately. Of course, there are drug interactions, commonly used drugs, you know, antifungal agents or other antiviral agents that affect the metabolism of these medications. And so the dosing should be decreased, or we should be looking at that if these medications are co-prescribed with a direct oral anticoagulant. And that certainly can elevate the levels and increase your bleeding risk. But again, I'm much more concerned about the risk of stroke because of non-adherence, because we see so much of that.
Well, you mentioned the effect of diet in there. So that kind of spins off into a couple of other tangential safety concerns that I can see. One is that the typical patient who is that we're concerned about stroke often have other conditions as well that we're treating. Just for example, you had mentioned the diabetic patient, and diabetic population is a large portion of patients that we often see in primary care, and they certainly have stroke risk. And at the same time, there's good nutrition counseling, losing weight, for example, to decrease a metabolic burden on the body. These are often therapeutic goals that we're looking for to better regulate blood sugar, to improve health overall. And yet, when you look at the ways that patients would approach that, if you want me to lose weight, well, I'll go on the latest fad diet of, I don't know, drinking go-go juice and dehydrating myself. And, you know, the effect that this has on, you know, potential drug, and we could say drug interactions, but really these are drug disease interactions. They're drug nutrient interactions. When you're changing your diet, when you start doing intermittent fasting and not eating, as you noted, that drug absorption, drug efficacy has changed when you have a meal or not. So what do you think is the best way to help protect patients? Is it an increase in communication with a doctor to say, hey, this is what I want to do? Is it, how do we manage that?
I think what you might be touching on a little bit is kind of how we monitor and how patients assess and kind of see maybe that they're responding to something. Maybe that's part of what you're saying when you talk about patients with diabetes. They can say, oh, I have this A1C I can look at and I can see how I'm doing. Maybe that's some of what you're getting to. And that's something that with certain therapies that we do, especially in primary care, it is frustrating for patients. You know, I can tell you, for example, that you should be on a statin medication to reduce your risk for a stroke or a cardiovascular event in the future. But you don't feel bad when your cholesterol is at a certain level. You don't feel bad just because your stroke risk is elevated because you have diabetes and other risk factors. So that's a conversation, and that is definitely an educational point. Like, you know, this is the importance of this medication, the importance. This is your, I can calculate and tell you how we calculate your risk for stroke if you have atrial fibrillation at this age and if you have these comorbidities. This is your risk for stroke in the next 10 years. And this is why this medication is so important for you. And this is why taking it properly is important, because this could happen to you. So it is, it's education and reiterating, and also medication reconciliation every time you see the patient. And I think it's important for the providers to actually say, are you taking this? Not just the person who's rooming the patient to check off, are you taking your medication all the same, but are you taking this every day? And are you having side effects? You know, making sure the patient knows this is important. But I think that falls onto the provider.
Thank you. And I think what I was trying to say, and somewhat inarticulately, was that patients will sometimes see a therapeutic direction, lose weight, manage your, eat better, and they will kind of take that and run with it. And without good communication with the provider, that may get them into trouble. And I think that's really what I was looking at, and both as a warning and, you know, for anybody listening, always talk with your PCP if you're taking these kinds of medications. But it also leads to the second concern, also dealing with communication, which is with the other providers that these patients see, because they go and they see the cardiologist, they see the dermatologist, they see the neurologist, the allergist, and so many other professionals, and the PCP is considered to be the hub and the master organizer directing all of this. But depending on how the insurance is structured, sometimes there are direct referrals where that patient will just go and get placed on medications. And now we are talking about drug-drug interactions, and we are talking about the necessity of medication reconciliation. So as a PCP, what kind of things do you do to kind of be aware of what's happening, and how do patients best communicate with you?
Yeah, I can say several things about that. The first is that I always ask all my patients and educate my patients on just having their updated medication list. Every time they leave my office, we, like I said, we make a point to reconcile their medications and make sure we're communicating with them and them back with us what you are actually taking, and that they leave with a current list, and that they, I tell them, take this home with you, carry this with you. If you go to see another provider, you show that to them so they have an adequate list, because ideally the electronic health record should help with that, right? We should be communicating across specialties, and they should be able to see. We can see pharmacy prescriptions of medications from other providers at the time that I'm seeing the patient, and we can ask them, are you taking this? Did the cardiologist start you on this medication? Did the dermatologist give you that? So we can look at that, but I don't know what other providers are doing, and other specialties. They have a different system. They may not know that. So just at base, having the patient share with whoever's seeing them, this is what I am taking, so that they can know, and if there's potential interaction, that falls on that provider who's prescribing a new medication to communicate that with the PCP to discuss it, or to give them pause whether or not they want to prescribe something with a potential interaction. I mean, then the next stopgap, or the next point where we could have an impact, is at the pharmacy where it's filled, right? I get many phone calls from a pharmacy, you know, the patient is on this and they've been prescribed this, you know, and so that's an excellent tool when we have communication across, you know, not just specialties, but between the pharmacy and the providers. Is obviously, there have been times when they have saved us in saying, hey, this was prescribed for your patient. Did you know? Yeah.
I'm so glad that you bring in pharmacists, but that's just a personal bias because we do very much try to bridge the gap of communication when we see this. And without going into great detail, I can certainly attest that some of the I think, more satisfying work that I've been involved with was actually tying together the, I think, three different specialties to regarding a drug interaction with a transplant patient and the psychiatrist and the PCP and working through a three-way interaction.
That's huge. I mean, we need that. I mean, there's so many drugs now. I mean, you think about, you know, decades ago, it was very few therapies and, you know, there were little that you had to know as a primary care doctor. And now with the different specialties and the different drugs and all these people co-managing patients and unfortunately, the communication between these different electronic health records is fragmented. So it's critical that we have, you know, everybody on board and everyone communicating. So that's necessary.
There's a moving to look at how perceptions of healthcare are changing the experience of healthcare for our patients. I can remember my grandparents, for example, grew up out of the Great Depression and viewed doctors as just a little lower than God. Whatever they said, you do. That is not the case today. And we may say sadly so. Looking at a positive spin, I mean, we understand that there are many things that medicine doesn't have explanations for. And as patients go outside traditional bounds to find answers, sometimes they don't always equate things like dietary supplements or nutritional practices as medication, and they wouldn't think to put that on a medication reconciliation. Some of these may be complementary therapies, and as a clinician, you look at that and say, well, that's great. And I'll speak as a pharmacist when somebody tells me that they have muscle aches and pains from a statin, for example, and they're taking CoQ10 or coenzyme Q10. The other name is ubiquinone. It's very common. And the data is a bit equivocal, doesn't look like it helps, doesn't look like it harms. And hey, if it works for you, then go ahead. It's complementary. It's addressing a side effect that go right ahead. But when it comes to anticoagulants, are there some therapies that you're aware of that are in a similar way somewhat complementary that we're just not trained in with respect to a Western medicine tradition that are helpful? And or the therapies that we look at and we say, oh, that is problematic. You really don't want to do that if you're on anticoagulant therapy. And I'll throw out an example of one that as a pharmacist, again, I would recommend against is don't do high vitamin E therapy if you're on anticoagulant therapy, because vitamin E will act as an analog that disrupts the clotting cascade at high doses, and you're going to expose yourself to higher risk of bleeding.
Yeah. So you could probably speak better to like the supplements and the herbs that might interact with the direct oral anticoagulants, but I definitely research and I ask patients if they're taking anything else, any supplements, any over-the-counter for that very reason, so that I can look, you know, specifically at their drug that they're taking. But again, anything that would interfere or either increase or decrease the activity of those liver enzymes that metabolize some of these direct oral anticoagulants can have a significant impact on the levels of those drugs. So that's always a consideration. I don't know of anything that can be used as an alternative to direct oral anticoagulants, like a supplement or an herb that can be used with the same benefit for a patient. There's no evidence of anything that I know of that can in any way, shape, or form be the same type of therapy that we can get and the same benefits for a patient. But I will say that just goes back again to the importance of that communication and the discussion with the patient and the communication between the provider, the pharmacist, and the patient. And, you know, sometimes people tell things to the pharmacy that they don't tell their provider, or they're just, you know, they don't think about it. You know, even the best provider can ask. You know, you can ask somebody, one person can ask you when you walk in the room, the next person can ask and get a different answer. So it's important, and it is something that I often see as a failure of communication, because, like you said, people don't see foods or dietary supplements, vitamins as medicine. They're more willing to trust what they read online or that they saw on social media as a therapy. And for whatever reason, they're quick to fall in line with that if they feel it is natural. So it may be seen as more safe. People have that perception if it's natural. And I tell people, there are things that are found in nature that will kill you. It doesn't just because it's in nature doesn't mean it's necessarily safe, you know? So we have to, and I think my patients know that about me, and they're very quick to say, you know, I'd like to take this mushroom and I'd like to do this. And should I do that? Is it okay? Is it safe? And then I have to go out and research like the safety of all these eccentric, these off the wall supplements I've never even heard of. But I do that because I want people to know that I'm a partner with them and that I appreciate that people have, a desire to look outside of traditional medicine and that some things can be complementary. And I basically tell them, if I don't see a safety risk, even if I can't tell you that there's any efficacy, my main concern is your safety with what I know, and I will do everything I can to keep you safe. So if I feel that there is no safety concern, there's nothing documented, no evidence of that in any reports, I don't see any efficacy, but you do what you will with that information. That's basically what I tell my patients. If I tell them I can't find any evidence, no studies, no trial, I really don't recommend those things for patients.
And I'll add on to that for any listening. The two things that I will usually advise patients is natural does not mean safe. Digitalis is natural. It will kill you. Mm-hmm. Mushrooms are natural. Mm-hmm. You do not want to eat every mushroom that you find in the forest.
That's right. Cyanide, peach pits. I mean,
some will kill you. And the other thing that I say is, if it's strong enough to do something good, then it's strong enough to do something bad. Because whether it's good or bad is a subjective assessment. Mm-hmm. That's something that you desire versus something you don't. But the substance doesn't care. It's just going to act. You're the one that determines whether it's good or bad. So if it's that potent and you're taking it to produce an effect in your body, then it may produce other effects that you may not appreciate as much. So those are my two for that. Going into management, when you have these patients, they're going to experience acute illnesses, acute exacerbations, and the presence of anticoagulation can complicate that to quite an extent. So in your mind, what are the situations that are most problematic or that complicate the patient who's anticoagulated the most?
What I see typically is maybe not, say an acute infection or acute, issue in that regard, but, certainly when people are having, procedures, that's what I encounter the most is management of the medication around the time that they're having procedures, or if they need to be admitted and maybe there's a cessation in their therapy for whatever reason. That's what we end up having to deal with most often, how to safely, when to safely stop their anticoagulant, whether it needs to be stopped at all. If it's a superficial procedure, we get many calls for oral procedures from the dentist, skin procedures, which typically we don't need to stop their anticoagulant therapy. And thankfully, most of the time we get a call beforehand, before someone will tell a patient to stop their therapy. You know, it really depends on the bleeding risk of the procedure, and that's how we proceed with recommending, you know, the timing and or whether or not they need to stop the medication at all.
And with that cessation, how concerned are you, and have you seen rebound thrombosis, where the body reacts in such a way that the risk for coagulation, the risk for generating a clot as a result of a sudden cessation, is increased? And I know that in the hospital, we'll use bridging techniques. We'll use a heparin, for example, and try to stop it just before the procedure. But some patients are not only on a DOAC, the direct oral anticoagulant, but they're also on antiplatelet therapy or something like aspirin, which some of those may result in an increase, actually, in production of platelets and corresponding risk for clot.
I actually can say in the time I've practiced, I haven't really seen that much. The times that I've seen that are in patients, for example, who had a previous thrombosis or pulmonary embolism and had a genetic disorder that predisposed them to thrombosis. And in that case, it was not diagnosed at the time they were initially put on the medication and they were on an appropriate duration of therapy and then stopped and then had another event and had I can think of a couple patients where that happened and then were like, you're on this medication lifelong. And those are the people that we would actually bridge in an outpatient setting because they've already demonstrated that they have a recurrent thrombosis when their medication is stopped. So those are the patients I would bridge if they have to, for whatever reason, stop their oral anticoagulation. But most of the patients who were treating for arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation, it is an increased risk if you stop, say, for 5 days of taking your direct oral anticoagulation for whatever reason, for a procedure. There is an increased risk of stroke in that 5 days, but it's a small increased risk. And I have not seen anybody that had an event in that window. And then we get them right back on the oral anticoagulation as soon as possible.
Very good. I want to kind of go back to an example that was discussed in the previous, where we call it grandma gone bad. This is a person who's usually presenting with a concern for bleeding in an emergency department, although they very well could present with a concern for clotting due to non-adherence or just having an event. What does the care of that patient look like from your perspective? Let's take the bleeding episode, for example, of the person who may have been slightly forgetful, maybe early dementia, and for a couple of days took the medication incorrectly. They fell, they bleed, they show up in the emergency department, and you're coordinating now a discharge plan with that acute care provider. And suddenly this person's mobility has changed, the safety, their home environment's changed, the involvement of other family members and supports may have changed. What does that look like for you?
Well, first I would say, in that specific example that you gave, if there's a patient, maybe elderly, has a fall and has demonstrated a bleed as a result of maybe... because of cognitive impairment, they're not dosing medication correctly, or they just happen to have unfortunate a bleed, an intracranial bleed or otherwise, they have a major bleed while on the direct oral anticoagulant. At that point, we're really considering whether anticoagulation is even appropriate for that patient. And I would not really recommend that. Again, if you're talking about the kind of situation that you discussed, their home life, that's a whole nother story. Most patients, if they have cognitive impairment and they've demonstrated bleed, I'm not going to recommend anticoagulation again. And that bears out, you know, in the evidence that if patients have had a major bleed, then that really gives us pause and we really have to consider the risk of bleeding versus the risk of thrombosis. There are tools to use to assess people who've had, you know, atrial fibrillation and who are diagnosed with atrial fibrillation and what is their risk for a stroke, right? We use those tools to kind of estimate. And the same is true for bleeding risk. We have tools to estimate what is this person's individual risk of bleeding in the future if we put them on an anticoagulant. Unfortunately, those tools were used or they were designed for people on warfarin, so we can't necessarily say that they are applicable specifically to direct oral anticoagulants, but we still use those two to just kind of overall get an idea of what's your risk of bleeding if we put you on something. But I think the data just kind of bears out that the patient's risk, if they have atrial fibrillation, for example, and if their stroke risk is high, their risk for a stroke really, really outweighs the risk of our concern of their risk of a major bleeding. And most of the studies, when they compare patients who are falling at home, elderly patients who have atrial fibrillation, and we know they've had falls at home, their risk of stroke is, if their risk of stroke is high because of that atrial fibrillation and they're on an anticoagulation, there's no difference in the risk of bleeding, whether they're on anticoagulant or they're on aspirin or they're on nothing. There's no increase. They're at increased risk of bleed just because they're fall, just because they're elderly. But it doesn't matter if they're on an anticoagulation or not. They still have an increased risk of bleeding. So it doesn't increase their risk from having falls at home. And there's another study that looked at, and again, this was looking at warfarin, looking at patients who have falls at home, and the anticoagulant, I think it was, I can't remember if it was Eliquis or what, no, it was still warfarin, but that you would have to fall like almost 300 times in a year to make the risk of taking the anticoagulant outweigh the benefit of the anticoagulant. So again, I don't really look at fall risk in my elderly patient alone in a vacuum. I don't use that as a deciding factor of whether or not a patient should be on anticoagulation or not, because I know patients fall, and elderly patients certainly fall at home. And that is a risk in general, whether we're talking about osteoporotic fractures or bleeds. And we certainly educate our patients, if you're on an anticoagulant medication and you fall, we need to talk to you. We need to know, did you have any potential head trauma? You need to be evaluated in the emergency room. We need to make sure you have not had a bleed. However, that does not mean that every elderly person who has had a fall or a couple falls, I'm going to automatically refuse to start them on an anticoagulant, because the data doesn't bear out that there's any increased risk just because they fall.
You mentioned aspirin in there and the equivalence of risk in a particular clinical situation. Is a patient who experiences an event, which is going to be experienced as a traumatic event, usually if you fall, end up going to the emergency department and have this sudden disruption in life, are they going to be at risk of, from your perspective at least, of perhaps saying, you know, this anticoagulant, is there a lighter form of anticoagulant? Can I just take a baby aspirin a day? Will that be helpful? It may not provide as much protection, but it provides, more than nothing. Is that a bargain that you see or come across?
Oh yeah, absolutely have. I try, vehemently to explain to people that that is not the equivalent of an oral anticoagulant, but that has come up many times in my practice of patients say, well, I'll just take an aspirin instead, or that's certainly a misunderstanding that people have. They think of it as something equivalent. And that's a key educational point for my patients.
And yet many times those same patients in other settings, and I say this in thinking of the cardiac patient who's undergone stent where antiplatelet therapy is a cornerstone for that patient, may be having difficulty crossing the bridge that your risk for clot and stroke is different than the risk for a platelet thrombus and mm-hmm. heart attack. Mm-hmm. And there's two completely different mechanisms that are causing these.
Right. It would take a lot of knowledge, medical knowledge and education, to understand like clot formation and thrombus and, how even clots are degraded over time and, the fibrinogen pathway, all of that. Like, patients really don't have that kind of knowledge. So, I can kind of share with people, this is a different process that we're attacking, and we try to talk about addressing things from different angles and, but it does take a lot of knowledge to understand all of that. So it comes back to, I think, trust and communication with the provider and understanding this medication is for this, this medication is for that. And there are specific reasons why we recommend each and not in isolation.
What are the top couple of tips that you would give other primary care providers for enhancing the safety of their patients with oral the anticoagulation?
Well, the first is what I've already kind of hammered home, is the medication reconciliation and communicating that directly with the patient and the provider. And then the open communication about what what that means for them, you know, the cost, because I think some people don't feel comfortable telling their provider. They may even tell you they are taking the medication, but they may not feel comfortable saying, well, the donut hole and it's too much and I'm not taking it now. Or, yeah, I was taking it, but I stopped because, you know, it's going to cost me $600 this month. So I think that's the most important. There are some programs out there with Rivaroxaban. You can get coverage for patients in that donut hole to when they have that gap in their Medicare Part D. And Bristol Myers Squibb has a program to help based on income to help people get their Eliquis or their Apixaban. But it takes communication with the patient to know that that's an issue. Also education about, you know, what to look for with these medications, when to seek care, if you fall, those types of things. It's critical. I think that's the most important piece. And of course, the importance of dosing appropriately, right? Apixaban is twice daily versus the Rivaroxaban, which is once daily with food. You know, just taking the time to stress how important that is in terms of getting actual benefit from these very expensive medications.
Absolutely. And speaking to the patients, what are the top couple of tips you'd have for patients who are going on anticoagulation to be as safe as they can when they're on this therapy?
You know, we always hear about people complaining about bruising. That's unfortunate. So we just try to give people a heads up and let them know, yes, you might notice some increased bruising. You might bleed a little bit longer if you cut, but just anticipate that and don't stress about that. But if you're seeing a problem, any signs of gastrointestinal bleeding, any black stool, any, you know, significant blood in your stool, we need to know about that immediately. You need to get in and seek care immediately. I mean, and it's, again, and just communicate with me. If you have side effects, if you start a new medication, if a provider puts you on another medication, if it's an antibiotic even, or the patients perceive antifungals, antivirals, antibiotics as the same thing. So if somebody puts you on something, even for a short time, let me know immediately, or, you know, talk with the pharmacist. So those are, I think, the important things for the patient is we need to know what's happening, and then you need to communicate if you have any concerns.
And I'll add on top of that the importance of the adherence to the medication regimen and being consistent, mm-hmm. not to just take it upon yourself to go every other day. Mm-hmm. You know, that with these medications, the seesaw effect of being mm-hmm. anticoagulated mm-hmm. and not can actually stress the body, I think, even more than being in one state or the other.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's part of that communication.
Any last thoughts for our listeners? Any words that you'd want to pass on?
I just think that this is an important discussion. Thank you for allowing me to participate in it. It's a challenging one because overall, I think that the benefits of the direct oral anticoagulants versus warfarin therapy are huge for patients. I'm a little bit disheartened by the cost, you know, and that's a whole nother discussion for another day, that the cost of pharmaceutical medications in this country, because if the cost was not a consideration, I think we would be having maybe not even have this conversation. Again, would just urge people to have open communication with their providers, with their pharmacists, with every specialist that they see, and ask questions and make sure they feel informed when they make a decision about what therapy they're comfortable with. It may not fit for them. It may not fit for their bank account, their lifestyle. It may not fit for their home life. It may not, you know, maybe warfarin is a better option for them. But making sure that they're getting treated for whatever their underlying condition is the ultimate bottom line.
Well, thank you so much for the information you shared and the wisdom. I know this. Our goal here is just to be able to have these experiences, have these discussions, share the information so that we can learn to care safely for our patients.
Thank you.
So that was our primary care physician. I think she did a fantastic job. It was an awesome conversation. I hope you got a lot out of that. I sure did. I got a lot of tips that I can take and put into practice, especially some counseling advice when I'm speaking with patients. So as always, I appreciate the time that you've given us, the ears that you give us to listen. Thank you to all the primary care physicians who do work to stitch together a lot of different professionals, a lot of different consulting specialties, to see that the care of the patient is as seamless as possible and as connected so that the patients get the very best care. Your work and your tirelessness is so appreciated. Thank you for that. And as always, I hope that we've learned something that will help us to care safely.